The next case on for oral argument this morning is State of Minnesota versus Matz. Council, as you're getting yourselves situated, I'll just remind you of our rules. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument, with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use that time. The timing restrictions are indicated in the light and clock that is in the lectern, and which you probably already know, but there's a button right in the front of the lectern that allows you to raise or lower it to match your height for your convenience. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, and whenever you are ready to proceed, you may.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning.
Good morning.
Back when I got out of law school about over 30 years ago, my first job was as a law clerk in Hennepin County District Court working for the Honorable David Duffy. And in the year and a half or so that I worked there, we frequently had police officers come in to have the judge sign search warrants. And I would bring the law enforcement officers in. The judge would have them sworn in, and he would then review the warrant and the warrant affidavit. And it would be totally silent inside his chambers as he would read the warrant closely. And he would sit and he would ponder and read those, and frequently took more time reading that warrant than it would certainly take to read the words. And sometimes he would just sign the warrant and send the law enforcement officer on their way with a kind word, and that would be it. But sometimes he wouldn't. Sometimes he would go through the warrant with the officer, and he would ponder what was going on and tell the officer what was missing from the warrant. And in those cases, and it happened frequently, the law enforcement officer would leave and might come back a few minutes later, might come back a few hours or a few days later with a new affidavit or with information added to it. And that should have been done here. We know that adding something to the search warrant occurred even in this case, or to the search warrant affidavit, because there's some additional information written in the law enforcement officer's hand below what was typed in it originally.
Well, I was looking at other additional information, which was the district court's discussion of what the facts were. And I'm wondering, where did the district court get those facts?
Your Honor, I
does the record tell us?
The record doesn't say anything other than, and I was the lawyer on the case down below, we submitted the search warrant and application, an affidavit. That was all that was submitted to the court. What I think took place, and I don't want to get into speculation, and I think I think that this is probably what took place. In the state's brief to the trial court, they put in all kinds of other facts that were outside of the affidavit. And I think that was done because the overall issue was to ultimately argue that there was probable cause to move forward with the case, but that assumed that the court was going to allow in what was found in the search warrant. And we discuss it on, I think, pages 14, 15, 16 of our brief, and the court's, you know, the trial court's memorandum is in there.
But at the time of the trial court's memorandum, has there been a hearing with testimony or affidavit submitted in addition to the application for a warrant?
No.
Well, we do allow additions to an application, just sworn testimony.
Mm-hmm.
I assume the officer was sworn here, so you suppose some of this other information came in from the officers in a colloquy with the court in terms of it being sworn testimony, but then part of our rule also requires that it be reduced to writing so we know what it was.
Yeah, no, I don't think anything
like that, do we?
No, I don't think anything like that came in. I mean, it was here is the search warrant and an affidavit, and counsel, go out and submit your briefs to me. And then the state in their memorandum recounted all kinds of things that clearly came out of the discovery. I'm sure some of that was in the probable cause portion, so the judge could have seen that. I was going to go part by part through that with the court. As you read that, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever of how the judge could get to that, because the entire inquiry here starts and ends with the search warrant affidavit. It's the four corners of that affidavit. That's what Judge McGill below saw. So Judge Scoggins that wrote the opinion in the district court, all he was supposed to look at was the affidavit, the four corners of this warrant and that affidavit in making his decision, and he pulled in facts that are completely outside it, not in the record, can't be considered, shouldn't have been considered, and can't be considered in this appeal. So I haven't seen something like that in a long time. I was shocked when I read it. I'm still shocked. Last night I read through it again. It is just him coming to the conclusions he came to brought facts that aren't in the record, that weren't what Judge McGill was had before him, and that's all he could go out and consider. And then he added inference to inference in trying to come to a conclusion.
So when I look at your argument, I want to be clear about what's here or what I see here and what I don't see here. So as I read the affidavit, it looks like there's a detective who's saying to the court through an affidavit that Mrs. Matz communicated to a caller, who apparently is a mandatory reporter, who communicated to Hennepin County Child Protection, who communicated to the detective, who then wrote this affidavit. I see a challenge in your brief to the timing, that we don't know when this incident occurred that's reported in the affidavit. And there's a challenge to whether or not there's probable cause of a crime. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't see in your brief a challenge to the reliability of this caller, this unnamed caller. There's no argument that there's insufficient basis to rely upon this person's report about a conversation that this person had with Mrs. Katz.
You don't see a challenge in there, and we didn't make that specific challenge, Your Honor. I think because you don't even get there to the reliability. There's clearly nothing in there that would go to the reliability that speaks to that, so I think that's clear on its face. I'm not saying that it's unreliable. It's just information, hearsay put out there into a paragraph, and that's all it is. But we never even have to get to that because there's absolutely no time frame.
Whether you have to get to it or not, I just want to be clear that your brief doesn't get to it.
Correct.
We haven't presented that on appeal.
Correct. And Your Honor, I think what an idea on this thing, Your Honors, is, we don't know anything about the timing. That's clear from what our brief is talking about. We hear about things all the time where people go in and start and have memories from way in the past or problems that they can just never get rid of. And they're in seeing a therapist and they're talking about something that might have taken place 15 or 20 years ago. It is just as a hypothesis.
You say therapist. I'm looking at the affidavit. How do we know on our review of this case, de novo, looking at the affidavit, that we're talking about a therapist? Well, does the affidavit say that it's a therapist?
It says, Your Honor, that the report indicated that a mandated reporter called to report that Mrs. Matz had found the pornography. Then it said that, and she mentions that it's nude females that appear to be 12 years of age. It says the reported, but I think they mean the reporter advised that Mrs. Matz believed that the photos, and it goes on and on.
Right. Are you conceding that that the district court knew this was a therapist? This caller?
You know, your point is well taken. I mean, we talk about this therapist in there because that's what was brought in.
That's what the district court said, but yeah. I'm looking at the affidavit.
No, there's nothing in there specifically about a therapist.
How do you, can you address the statement in State v. Harris where the Supreme Court says that the absence of timing is not a per se, is not per se fatal to the affidavit for a warrant?
Certainly, Your Honor. You know, what I would say about State v. Harris, you know, it's an unpublished decision that dealt with controlled substance crimes, and I think it's totally distinguished.
State v. Harris, the Minnesota Supreme Court case, a published case from 1999.
Is that 589, 782?
It is.
Oh, okay. I had written down my notes unpublished. I may have...
No, it's our Supreme Court.
Right, it's amend 1999. Your Honor, what went on in that case, though, and this is the answer to your question, would be this. If things in the affidavit that are put in there can somehow, clues can somehow convince the court as to timing and that they might reasonably find something at the current time of something that happened in the past, then you could get around that time element. And I would state with respect to State versus Harris, there were two trash pulls within 72 hours of the warrant that was issued, and they found syringes and a glass bulb that had residue of methamphetamine on them.
I wonder whether you're confusing Harris with another case. Harris is a first-degree murder case.
Your Honor, are you, and I just throw this, what year was it?
1999. You had the right citation, 589 Northwest 2nd, 782. Maybe you've just,
yeah.
Maybe in your research you got these two crosses, but this, Harris was a murder case, and it involved an affidavit that included a request, included information that was based on a surveillance video of when the defendant or when a person, presumably the defendant, went into or out of an apartment that might have given him access to the murder victim. Does that ring a bell?
And it does, Your Honor. With all due respect, I believe, and I could be wrong in this, I believe that may be State versus DeWald, 463 Northwest 2nd, 741. It's a Minnesota 1990 case. I could be wrong on that, but it was a very gruesome murder case. It involved the...
You're wrong on the citation, unless Westlaw has their... numbers messed up. It is 589, 782 that I'm referring to. But
Your Honor, I'd say this. I did review that case. I'm sorry if that's my mistake. With the State versus DeWald, it was a gruesome murder case with the baseball bat. They had seen the person was ran out of the house and everything else. What I would say with that...
different case.
I believe that had to do with were you getting to the enduring utility sort of argument?
No, I'm getting to the time. And if you're not, I gather that maybe your cases got mixed up, so maybe you're not that familiar with this case. But it's a case that involves a murder, and the suspect was someone had come and gone from an apartment of the victim during the night of the murder, and there's a question as to whether the defendant was that person. And the affidavit that supported the search warrant application there's a search warrant sought based upon a videotape that appeared to be the defendant coming and going from the apartment building, a surveillance video, and there was no time attached to that. And the argument was, because the affidavit didn't say what time this video captured him coming or going, that ends the argument that's being made now, that timing is dispositive, you need it, otherwise we don't know if it's stale. And the Supreme Court there said, no, timing is not per se fatal.
And, Your Honor, I'm not asking you the question, but rhetorically I would say, were there other clues there that allowed the court to realize and believe, the court that issued it below, to think that something had just currently and recently taken place? The case that the State v. Harris that I've written down, my State versus Harris, basically, though, to talk to this idea that there was nothing in the affidavit about time, but they had just within 72 hours of the warrant gone out and done some trash pulls and had found some stuff, and the officer had made some other observations, I think, about things that appeared to support that, and those clues were helpful to the court.
The whole issue of staleness has to do with whether or not you have any probative evidence to pointing in the direction that you can expect to find something now, because it was there last hour, last week, 2 years ago, probably not. So it's the closeness of time is really to determine whether there's enough, whether that evidence is probative in any way to establish that we have a reason to believe it's still there.
Correct. And the issue that this whole case brings up is there's no time frame whatsoever in the affidavit. There's nothing. It could have been Mrs. Motz talking to someone and something, seeing this these images that she saw 20 years ago. It could have been 15 years ago. It could have been 10 years ago. There is no time element whatsoever on that affidavit. It's all within the four corners right here. And we don't, as we make clear in our brief, we don't even get to staleness in a case like this because there is no time frame. We've got all these cases that are cited, and they talk about State versus Janetta.
If there's no time frame, then we don't know that it isn't stale.
Your Honor, with all due respect, if you don't know that it isn't stale, then you should the judge below should go out and have more information put into that so that we know that it's not stale. Because I don't think that the idea here is we're going to start issuing warrants on the idea saying, hey, we don't know that it's stale, or we think it may or may not be stale. We, I believe, have to know that there's some sort of time element with this. And if
so
you've got none.
The proposition that if, in fact, there's nothing in that affidavit that gives us a time frame, then we start with the proposition that we don't know. We don't know when this happened.
And that's where Judge Duffy, back in Hennepin County 30 years ago, would say, I just don't know. I don't know when you're talking about. Did this happen 10 days ago? Did it happen 10 months ago? Did it happen 10 years ago?
What, if I may, Judge Ross, what about the word already appears in the third paragraph, second line. The officer contacted the investigator in child protection. She advised that she had already met with the family. Doesn't that imply that there's a short period of time between the report and the information that had been received?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, but so this is how I would answer this, is that that's what it says there. So when the officer called that child protection services person, she says, oh, I've already met with the family about this. The issue isn't that she, because you're right, it seems to imply, the inference is that it was sometime recent. But that's not the inquiry that the court is interested in when we look at this search warrant. It's when did Mrs. Motz see those images? If that was 20 years ago and she just couldn't get over that, and now her daughter is coming, she's got married, and she's now her daughter's coming to be 6 years of age, and it's just keeping her up at night, and she goes and talks to her therapist about this, and it somehow gets reported to child protection. It's when did she see those? And if I could just say this, it's very short, is the four or five questions that I think should have been asked by Judge McGill and may have been asked by Judge Duffy if we were back in those days again.
Why don't you hold that until...
Was this?
Why don't you hold those questions? I think you've answered Judge Johnson's question. And then since you're well over your time, you'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for the State.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Caitlin Lynch. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this appeal. The district court's suppression order and appellant's conviction should be affirmed because the totality of the circumstances contained in the search warrant application, together with the reasonable inferences that can be drawn therefrom, provided the judge who signed that search warrant a substantial basis to conclude that probable cause existed.
Can it be?
What in this affidavit suggests to the magistrate that these photos would still be at the house at the time of issuing the warrant?
Sure, Your Honor. There's a few different factors that I'd like to point out, starting with the case law. It's well established that, of course, this is a totality of the circumstances test.
But that's just a flag we run up the pole and say it's totality, and no one really spends a lot of time analyzing what that means after we got rid of some cases that described how you go about analyzing applications for a search warrant. But what specifically in this affidavit or case law that gives a magistrate a basis to conclude that that evidence that's described is there now? That's the whole purpose for the warrant, to go and seize what is there now, not something that may have been there a year ago or 2 years ago or whenever. Isn't that right? And so it's pretty critical that the magistrate have some reason to believe, I think that's the standard for probable cause, reason to believe that the evidence is there now, and therefore we issue the warrant now. What in this affidavit directs to that issue?
Your Honor, first I would direct your attention to this court's decision in State v. Brennan, I believe that was 2004, where this court said that due to the unique nature of child pornography, the possession of child pornography, it's a secretive crime, solitary, out of view of others, that it's reasonable in the probable cause analysis to rely on the officer's training and experience. So that's where I'll start first.
Okay, well, here, what training and experience did the officer identify?
Sure. The officer testified through the affidavit that in his 11 years experience and training investigating these types of crimes, it's his experience that child pornographers store these images on electronic devices like we had here, that child pornographers, quote, rarely, if ever, dispose of the evidence. And the reason for this, according to the...
So are you saying that that means there can't be any issue of staleness here because even if it was seen 2 years ago, it's probably still there? Is that the argument you're making?
Your Honor, it's the state's position that the circumstances, the totality of the circumstances in the warrant application provided a reasonable basis for the judge who signed the warrant to conclude that the information was at least recent. It was certainly fresh. There was enough basis here for the magistrate judge to conclude that evidence would still be found. And in addition to the officers...
I want to be clear, just so I can take you back to Judge Klopacki's question, because I'm curious to your answer. Is it your position that time doesn't matter?
No, Your Honor.
So do you agree that there's nothing in the affidavit that allows the magistrate or us to determine when the Mrs. Motz saw the information, saw the photographs that she relayed to this caller, unnamed, unspecified caller, who relayed the information to Hennepin County, who relayed the information to the detective, who told the court?
Your Honor, we don't have an exact date. That is true.
When you say exact date?
Well, we don't know.
Do we have a year?
We do not have a year. We don't have a date. We don't have a time.
Let's talk
what
about
we do.
Let me,
oh, I'm sorry.
I just want to push you on a few other things that were troubling me about the affidavit. How reliable is the caller? We know that this is a caller. The caller got information from Mrs. Motz and related to Hennepin County. How reliable is the caller? What does the affidavit tell us about that?
Your Honor, the caller was reliable. In the probable cause analysis, the magistrate judge can look at the basis for knowledge and veracity of informants, and here the caller was specifically named as a mandated reporter in this affidavit.
So what is it about being a mandated reporter that makes one reliable? A mandated reporter is simply someone who happens to serve in an occupation or have some relationship with the state or an agency that would require that person to make a report. What is it about that in itself that makes the individual reliable?
Well, the magistrate judge is entitled to draw reasonable inferences, and here, based on, instead of just calling this caller a tipster or just a regular citizen informant, this specific phrase, mandated reporter, the magistrate judge would have known that by using that phrase, this caller had a statutory mandate to report, that something triggered that statutory mandate, and that while the magistrate judge may not have known exactly, you know, what statute that was, it's reasonable to infer, looking at this affidavit in a practical, common sense way, and giving the appropriate deference to the magistrate judge, that this mandated reporter would not have just flippantly reported anything or sat on information that clearly, because the affidavit states that appellant and his wife lived in the home with their 6-year-old daughter, that this information was reported up the chain out of for the safety of their and the well-being of their
well,
daughter.
You're drawing a lot of inferences that the affiant didn't include. I mean, you're telling a story that's maybe a compelling story, but are you troubled as I am by the district court's reliance on information that a lot of information that is nowhere in the affidavit?
Your Honor, the district court's reliance, or I wouldn't call it reliance because it was just in the facts section of the district court's order that they did recite facts that don't appear in the four corners, and I agree with appellant. This is a four corners of the affidavit review.
You agree that the basis for the factual basis for the district court's legal determination were erroneous in the sense that the district court was relying upon information extraneous to the affidavit?
No, Your Honor. In the district court's...
The district court is allowed to rely upon information that this was a therapist, that the therapist had undertaken this investigation, and and the timing and all the other circumstances that the district court included in the facts that supported the district court's decision. You believe that's appropriate?
No, those facts are not relevant to the legal issue here on appeal, which is the four corners, whether what the information the magistrate judge saw when he made that decision to sign the warrant provided a substantial basis, giving due deference to the magistrate judge, to conclude that probable cause existed. So that's the standard of review here. And I, again, I agree with appellant that this is a four corners analysis. So the district court's citation to other facts in its facts section is not relevant to the legal issue.
How
here
do I know there
appeal.
Is a crime committed? There's probable cause that a crime occurred.
Your Honor, the search warrant application provided a fair probability that evidence of a crime, here child pornography evidence, would be found during the search. So first of all...
Stop for a minute.
Sure.
And that's based upon the report indicated there were images of nude females that appeared to be 12 years of age. That's not a crime, is it? It doesn't describe a crime.
Your Honor, the affidavit describes the images in addition to describing that wife believed they were downloaded from the internet, and it also describes other facts. Again, the affidavit is supposed to be reviewed.
But simply in a picture of a nude female 12 years of age does not define a crime, does it?
If we were at trial, I don't know for sure, but probably not. Here, we just have to look for whether there's a probability, a fair probability, that evidence of a crime will be found.
Well, you need evidence of a crime. I mean, you need both. Often, when we have a search warrant, the detective knows a crime has been committed. The detective in Harris, for example, the detective is searching to find evidence of a murder. We know a murder was committed, so we know a crime was committed. Now we're looking for evidence. Or an informant says, I saw controlled substances, I saw crack cocaine in the defendant's apartment. We know a crime has been committed. And here we've got two problems, it seems to me. One is when this happened, and the other is what happened. So if the police go in and look and search the computer, and all we know, if they find what Mrs. Motz has reported, they will find an image or images of nude females, some of whom Ms. Matz believed may be 12 years old. So help tie the string together to establish that there's probable cause of a crime and that there's evidence of that crime that's going to be found here.
Yes, Your Honor. Appellant just stated here today that he's not challenging the reliability. Wife is not only presumed reliable, but she has several factors for why she is reliable. And she described what she believed was child pornography. Of all people, this is appellant's wife. They live in the house together with their six-year-old child. There's two important steps that wife took after she viewed this pornography.
I'm sure, people who aren't trained in the law who believe a nude photograph of a 12-year-old girl would constitute pornography because they're not familiar with the elements of pornography. Why does her reliability, assuming that she's reliable, it's not being challenged, that she saw something on the computer, but she saw what was described? How is her description enough for the district court to conclude that evidence of a crime was probable to be found in the apartment?
Yes, Your Honor. Again, looking at the totality of the search warrant, there were two important steps that wife took after she observed the pornography that strongly suggests that what she saw was not just mere nudity, it wasn't just a family photograph. First, she confronted her husband about it, and instead of denying it, it's very clear from the affidavit that he admitted that after being confronted, he went ahead and deleted the hard drive of his computer. That's consciousness of guilt. That's a factor that the Supreme Court in State v. Harris said that we can consider. Second of all, wife disclosed it to a third party, again, suggesting that taken together with the fact in the affidavit that they lived together with their six-year-old daughter. It's reasonable to conclude that from the facts here, a wife and a mother of a six-year-old daughter would not sit on information like this that she thought was child pornography.
No, I understand that, but I'm assuming that a wife and a mother who saw an image of a nude female, 12-year-old or whoever, on her husband's computer would be upset about that. And how does that establish that this was pornography? I mean, everything that you've described that she did would be consistent with someone who was upset about what she saw on her husband's computer. But I don't know that this gets us to the elements of a crime.
Your Honor, in addition to wife reporting this information, I would also note that based on these steps that she took, I think it is reasonable to infer that there was some sort of sexual component in what she saw on her husband's computer. And two other reliable informants here.
Even though not one word of that is in this affidavit.
Your Honor, we have what we have in the affidavit, and that's what we have to go off of here. And the courts are very clear, both the U.S. Supreme Court and Minnesota courts, that deference is owed to the magistrate judge, and deference is owed to our legal system's preference for search warrants. We prefer to have a neutral, detached judge review these warrants instead of having officers go out and do warrantless searches. So the purpose is not to look for some hypothetical...
Except, you know, those are nice platitudes, but application of those platitudes in this case is that the magistrate referenced things that weren't even in the affidavit. Doesn't look like a neutral, detached magistrate, does it?
Are you talking about the district court or the magistrate?
Well, I call it the person who's issuing the warrant. In the old term, we call them magistrates, but
right.
It's a district court. Here we had the magistrate, the district court judge, who's a detached, neutral, referencing things that aren't even in the affidavit.
Your Honor, respectfully, the district court was a different judge than the magistrate judge.
I'm talking about the magistrate judge.
Oh. Then I'm not following your question.
One that... go ahead.
Judge McGill.
Yeah.
So the...
Judge Scoggin included the extraneous information, and Judge McGill issued the warrant.
I understand that.
I have it backwards.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. You know, in the omnibus proceeding, that's kind of like the first layer of review. Here up on the kind of the second layer of review, the court is still reviewing the four corners of this affidavit to determine whether the magistrate judge, who did make this initial probable cause finding, had a substantial basis for doing so. And based on the ongoing and enduring nature of this type of crime, based on the sequencing of events, wife taking the two steps that she did, suggesting that what she saw was not just mere nudity, in addition to the affirmations of the officer and his training and experience, the totality of the circumstances that provided the magistrate judge with a substantial basis to conclude that probable cause did exist to search here. I see I'm out of my time unless you guys, the court has any further questions.
I just have one question of curiosity. Is it the pattern in Hennepin County for the officers to draft their own affidavits?
I'm sorry?
Is it the pattern and the practice of Hennepin County for the officers to draft their own affidavits and search warrant applications?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question because there was no omnibus proceeding transcripts. That's just not in the record.
I just ask it because it seems to me we probably wouldn't have this appeal if the county attorney's office had been involved in drafting the affidavit to start out with. The question that we raised about staleness, the question we raised about who saw what and when, what all the county attorney looking at it would have made sure that these items would have been filled in.
I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that again, it's a four corners analysis. We have the facts in the affidavit here provided the judge with a substantial basis to conclude that there was at least a fair probability that evidence of a crime would be found in the places to be searched. So unless there's further questions, the state respectfully requests that this court affirm the district court's order and appellant's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lynch. Rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Just a couple brief comments. The state, in its arguments...
Again, just for the record, if you state your name for each...
John Luneg for the appellant, Your Honor. Thank you.
Just so I understand, it was McGill that issued the warrant.
Correct.
And it wasn't McGill that made references to things outside of the four corners.
That's correct. That was Judge Scoggins. My brief statement would be this, Your Honors, and I think this just focuses in on what we're dealing with here. The state, in her very nicely done argument, fixates on the deference to be given to the judge and on the legal standards, and keeps on coming back to we've got to give deference to what Judge Scoggins decided. I think for all the reasons we...
Are we challenging the magistrates? Yeah.
No, we are. We are, Your Honor. I just going to say, for all the reasons I mentioned in the brief, Judge Scoggins' decision in this thing, I don't think it's the right one. But I would ask the court to remember what we should give some deference.
I mean, are you challenging McGill's issuance, or are you challenging Scoggins' failure to suppress the evidence seized?
I'll say both, Your Honor, but it's the issuance. It's obvious. We're challenging the warrant.
Sooner or later, you have to get to that, whether it's one step or two steps.
Yeah. So it's the warrant. And what I would ask the court to remember is that we should give some deference to the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution. The computer in this day and age is the receptacle of the most private affairs that people have. It talks about their taxes, their financial, their sexual preferences, their family matters, their employment, everything there is. And when a judge goes out and issues a warrant like this, what ends up happening is that police officers show up at their house and people get arrested and things get torn through in their whole house to go out and find this sort of stuff. That's some deference that the court's got to remember is important here.
To the second element of your argument where you're challenging whether or not there's enough in this affidavit to establish that a crime has occurred. Here you've got, in context, whether this is child pornography, I guess, is the question, or whether there's probable cause to believe that there will be evidence of a crime, and that crime here being child pornography is the issue. Here you've got an affidavit that, without regard to its gaps, it does indicate that a wife confronts her husband about images that appear to be a 12-year-old girl. The husband responds by referencing an addiction that he has to pornography, and then he wipes his computer. Why is that not enough to establish the link between what the images were that the wife saw and the element that you're referring, pornographic, not just nudity, but pornography?
Because, and it goes to the question you were asking before, a wife seeing pictures like this would say 99% of all people, not just wives, or girlfriends or anyone else, would think there's nude pictures of 12-year-old girls. That's pornography. People would just call it that, and that's something worrisome. So I don't think that we can go towards what the wife may have said. We're not sure exactly who came up with the pornography description because there's no real detail on that in there. But I was just going to say...
The point of his question, his point, I think, was that once the defendant acknowledges that he is addicted to pornography and to... after he's had the discussion with his wife, wipes the computer.
Mm-hmm. Again, this is speculation, but I would say that it would be a fairly common sense sort of thought that any guy that gets caught and his wife, you know, finds that stuff would get rid of it.
That's one reasonable inference. Another reasonable inference of this conduct is the consciousness of guilt of pornography. Isn't that another inference?
You know, I think it's a really thin and light inference, but it is an inference. There's lots of different inferences out there. It's why the judge should have asked more questions. He should have said, you know, go back and find out what these, that was one of the questions. What were these images? What did they show? If the investigator came back and said, in talking with Mrs. Motz, she's a known person, he could have gone back and done that. She said that it was lewd pictures of them showing their private areas. That would be something, and that would be that a crime, the what, judge, that you had gone to. What happened here? It would be the what. So in closing, I think that...
Mr. Luning, I'd like to ask a couple of questions about the timing issue. So let's assume a hypothetical warrant application that's very specific about dates. And if it's, and let's say that the mandated reporter called report that 1 week earlier, Mrs. Motz had seen these images. Would you be making this argument, or would this no?
No, I wouldn't.
What if it said 1 month earlier, 1 month before the report?
I might be making that argument, but I think that it would fail because of, I think that proximity is probably.
What about 3 months?
Probably the same.
About 6 months.
No, then I would be making a real strong argument that I don't think that's close enough in time to go in and invade a person's home to be looking for child pornography.
So in other words, I mean with child pornography, I mean it's reasonable for the judge reviewing the warrant application to assume that if it existed 3 or more months from the date of the application, that it's probably still exists.
I don't think I would argue against that. I really would. But could I say this, is that I'm aware of the case law that says 18 months, 2 years, 3 years. Clearly, there's with the receptacle of this information being in a computer, they look at this to that enduring utility sort of idea. But again, we don't have anything here. And if I could just posit this to the court, if pornography is something that's of such enduring utility, that the person would tend to keep it the way that they say in the boilerplate in the affidavit here, then why wouldn't the judge take more time and say, go out and find more? It's not like a drug case where we maybe better work pretty quickly and get in there because the drugs could dissipate. If it's of such enduring utility, we should demand that the district court judge below, when it's looking at an officer and going to sign an affidavit, that it go out and require that more information be brought forward.
Well, what additional investigation could be done without executing this warrant?
Go back and talk with Mrs. Motz and talk with that reporter and find out when. Find out the when and find out the what. When did she do this? If it came back and she says, oh, back when we were dating 16 years ago, I came in and I saw and he had images of 12-year-old nude girls on there, and he went out and he deleted his hard drive, I don't think anyone would ever grant a warrant for the Motz residence under those circumstances. If she came back in and said it was a week ago, as you just stated, I think that every judge would and should go out and grant that. But we don't know. That's why we can't even get to the staleness sort of issue here, because there's no time. There's no time, and there's no what happened.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very Koenig. Much.
Thank you, Ms. Lynch. Difficult issue, well argued, and well briefed. We appreciate that, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory period. The matter is under advisement. Thank you.
Thank you very much.